when it was all said and done between the recapture and the capital gain was 280,000-ish. It was right around, I think it was 278. When we did the cost seg, it lowered that to 212. And so there was a substantial difference, right? There was a big difference. It was, you know, 60 some thousand bucks. And people are thinking like, I can't do that. I already sold it. I sold it last year. Actually, as long as you can get access to the property, you can actually do the cost seg, even for last year. Cost segs aren't free, obviously, but you're looking at it. And I always say, if I can get 7 times a return on it. So I say, is the juice worth the squeeze? If I'm going to look at doing something, I'm going to spend $1, I want to get $7 back.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to another episode of the Passive Income Pilots. By popular demand, I have my co-host, Tate. We haven't fired him yet. No, I'm just joking. Tate, you're here. He kicked me off the last one. He sent me on to a trip down to Portland in the Cirrus. So I appreciate you, Tate, covering down with me.
And yes, Sam and I had a great time, man. We missed you.
I know. Yeah, so we had a great time, too. We had beautiful weather. We flew down to Sandy, Oregon to see one of our storage facilities. And we flew right over the top of Mount St. Helens, and it was a beautiful morning. It was a lovely day to fly. Perfect weather. But but back to business. We brought back Toby Mathis from Anderson Advisors to talk tax by popular demand. Toby, thanks for coming back and joining us.
Hey, it sounds like they're gluttons for punishment.
They're pilots. They want to know how all the tax stuff works, right? We're all like little micro engineers or quasi attorneys, the way we have to interpret regulation and things like that. So,
oh yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And Toby, that was our most listened to episode by far. Everybody was raving about it. So really happy to have you back on the show. We want to do a deep dive today on a couple things, starting with depreciation, and really get a good understanding of how depreciation works, particularly in real estate, and how it can be applied to gains, W-2, things like that, so that we can offset our taxable income. So, do you want to go ahead and just take it away?
Yeah, I could just, I mean, depreciation equals deduction. So in a real basic sense, you earn money as an individual. If you're an employee, then you pay taxes and then you get to spend what's left. If you're in the business world, you get to earn money, then you spend it and then you pay tax on what's left. And depreciation is the spending category. So when you have depreciation, what you're doing is you're earning money in your investment, usually like rental activity, for example. And then you get these deductions, and it might be property taxes, might be management fee that you're paying somebody, it might be insurance, it's repairs, you know, all the stuff that goes along with it. If you're doing a syndication, somebody else is paying that. And then you take depreciation. And depreciation is kind of a misunderstood concept. It's a deduction, but you might not be spending the money. So it's kind of this little mind warp. You know, to put it in an example that I understand is I like thinking about, you know, pizza shop. You know, you buy a big old oven, maybe you buy the big old oven on a 60-day or 60-month contract, no money down, right? You know, and they sell you a big old pizza oven. I might be able to write off that pizza oven. Let's say about $100,000 pizza oven. I might be able to write that whole $100,000 off the year that I buy it. Well, how much have you spent on it? It doesn't really matter, right? It's not about how much money came out of my pocket. What matters is, can I write that off over its useful life? The IRS gives everything a useful life. And does it create a deduction? So now let's go through the same thing. I have a pizza company. I make $30,000 a year. I buy a pizza oven for $100 minus the $100, and I have a negative $70, right? 30 minus $100 equals $70,000.
And that's negative. If it was 100% bonused in year one, or if it was all taken in year one, right?
Yeah, we have bonus depreciation. We have 179. 179, technically, you can't create a loss, so it would be zero. But you have 168K, which is this year is 80%. Last year was 100%. You know, it moves around. But let's just say you had 100% bonus depreciation. You're going to end up with a big old loss. Well, this is where you got to put on your little head warp glasses or whatever you want to do. Like you got to look at the world in that lens, and then you realize real estate's no different. Real estate, what they usually do is they're looking at it and saying, is it residential property or is it non-residential property? Residential property, you write off 27 and a half years is kind of the norm. Non-residential is 39 years. And you would write off and use up that property. So the useful life is how long would it last? So right. The IRS comes up with these numbers and you get to write off whatever you bought over that period of time. Go ahead, Tate.
Yeah. So I just want to really drive this point home. To me, for me, it makes sense when I think of something like a computer or, like you said, a pizza oven or a printer. You know, that printer might have a 5-year useful life, but at the end of it, it's essentially worthless, right? So that when you look at it like that, the depreciation makes sense. You buy a printer for $100, $20 a year that you get to write off on the loss. And when you're done with it, you kind of did lose that money because you spent it. Now you have a worthless piece of equipment, right? Mm-hmm. The reason that the IRS allows us to depreciate real estate, and you can't depreciate the land, right? It's just the structure. So those things do have useful life, but in general, real estate tends to increase in value. When you get to the end of 27 and a half years, it's usually not worth nothing. And then we're able to accelerate it as well. So I just wanted to plug that in.
Yeah. I mean, it's, But here's the thing is it may not be worth nothing, but you've had to you had to fix it.
True.
So on average, real estate has about a 5% pull of repair expense, right? Like there's some formulas you could use. Well, you add that up, it's 100% over 27 years or 39 years. It's, you know, if you're at 3%, 5%, whatever it is. Yeah, I had to replace that thing, all the time. Or if you just left a building vacant and abandoned for 39 years, how much is it worth at the end? It's probably a teardown.
Right.
So, that's what they're doing is they're saying the improvement. And you're right about the land. The land doesn't lose its value unless you start sucking things out of the land like oil or minerals, in which case you could have depletion. But for purposes of our sanity, just think if I built a building, I get to write it off over a useful life. The problem is carpet's not going to last 39 years. The problem is your driveway is not going to last 39 years. The fence you put around the property isn't going to make it 39 years. Most everything's not going to make it 39 years. Like you're having to fix it and replace it and do all this. So there's concepts there that now we have to look at. Let's just say you're smart and you buy, you guys always do self-storage, right? So you're looking at the self-storage and you're saying, are the walls temporary? Did we use drywall or did we use metal or something like that, right? Is it a temporary structure or is it permanent? That'll dictate whether it's 39-year property or whether it's something less. When I put in a parking lot, let's say that you have a storage facility that has dirt roads, can't depreciate that. I put asphalt on it, I can depreciate the asphalt. That's 15-year property.
Right.
All of a sudden, I have a much bigger deduction. But if you don't know to actually get what's called a cost egg done, you're writing that off over 39 years.
39 years.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that I think is important. Everything is stuck in the 39-year schedule unless you do the cost seg.
Yeah. And here's what's funny is it's actually an impermissible methodology to classify all your property as 39-year, 27 and a half year. I use houses because everybody can understand the house. You know, you walk up to the house, there's your driveway. It's beautiful. You know, maybe it's cement. Maybe you put in some wonderful pavers. You walk into you're walking through the front yard and there's these cute little trees that everybody's planted and there's a picket fence out front. And then you walk in the house and there's, carpeting, smells so good. It's brand new carpet and it's freshly painted and it's got some new velour or leveler blinds. And then you walk out in the backyard under the new deck and you see this beautiful cedar fence. If we're up in the Northwest, you got the cedar fence and you got some little trees planted back there. An accountant walks in there and they see, 15-year driveway. Oh, the fence is land improvement, 15 years. Oh, the carpet is 5 years. And oh, those new cabinets, those are 5-year, and the appliances are 5-year. And you, oh, look, there's a deck that's 15-year. And hey, look, the cedar, that's 15-year. That's what the IRS wants you to do. That's actually what you're supposed to do. So when you actually file the form, it's called a change of accounting. When you've owned a property for more than 1 year, you do this thing called a 3115, and it says, I'm changing from an impermissible method to a permissible method, and I'm going to write everything off faster. Now, here's the rub. When I do that, everything that's 20 years or less right now has bonus depreciation attached to it. Right. So anything that's 15-year property, I could write off in 2023, it's 80%. If right. I bought the property in a previous year, it's whatever it was in that previous year. So if I bought it in 2020, 2021, 2022, it's 100%. I think you're going all the way back to 2017. Like, you could be looking at a much larger deduction, and I can change that accounting methodology anytime I want to. So even if I've had a property for 5 years, I could say, hey, you know what? I've been writing it off over 27 and a half years, or I've been writing it off over 39 years. I'm going to change that, and I'm going to write it off over 5, 7, 15, and 27 and a half or 39 years. I'm going to
components. Yeah. So really the instant value add, if you're listening to this and you own rental property, single family home, commercial, doesn't matter. If you have a property that you're renting out and you haven't depreciated it and you haven't taken advantage of these tax benefits, you can go back and make that amendment. That's essentially what you're saying. And the other thing too is I want to make sure that people understand that these are just categorized buckets. So while a fence may not last or a carpet may not last 39 years, cabinets are 5-year life. And even if they last 30 years, mm-hmm. You still get that 5-year life because that's just what the IRS has decided.
Right.
Yeah. And I also even want to go a little bit more basic, which is depreciation isn't a bad thing for tax purposes. It's a good thing. It's a deduction. And appreciation is a good, so I hear a lot of time, like, appreciation is a good thing. I hear a lot of times, you know, people are like, well, depreciation isn't that bad, right? So I just want to clarify, this isn't your house losing value. This is purely a tax incentive. And then the last thing I want to kind of highlight is, you said 80% bonus depreciation. And if you guys listening haven't understood kind of what bonus depreciation is, it used to be 100%. So when Toby's saying, you can take 80% bonus depreciation, you're taking 80% of those total cost seg things like cabinets, countertops, appliances. Let's say all that totals up to $100,000 worth of value. You can take an $80,000 or 80% deduction. It used to be 100%.
For 5 years.
Up until 20,
Tax Cut Jobs Act.
Yeah, 2022. But now it goes 80% in 2023, 60% in 2024. And it phases out. So you can always take the cost seg. That's always been around, or it's been around for a very long time. The bonus depreciation is new in the 2017 tax code, and it burns off. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, okay, I've got this rental property and I've never done cost seg, it might be a good time to do it because this is the year that you can get 80%. Next year, you're only going to be able to get 60 and 40. And so you might be able to get a nice tax loss this year.
Right. Just one little clarification. What matters is the year that I put the property in service.
Oh, excellent. Perfect.
It doesn't matter what year I make the election. So like if I bought property 3 years ago, and in 2023, I say, you know what? I want to really lower my tax bill. I could do that. I could actually still do it for 2022.
Perfect.
I can actually make a change of accounting election up until my return is due plus extension. So if it's your property, say you're a pilot and you have property out there and you keep getting, let's say it's $10,000 a year of positive cash flow, that's taxable income. Hey, I have rents hitting my return, because we know that it has nothing to do with the actual money you receive. It has how much at the end of the day I have to report on my tax return. I could be receiving $30,000 a year, but I only have to pay tax on 10 because I have depreciation. Like, even though we bonus this, we don't lose the ability to depreciate the rest of that structure. Or if I have 80% bonus depreciation, I still get to write off the other 20. It's just over that longer time period. It's 5, 7, 15 year, or the, you know, 39 year if it's storage. But what I'm looking for is, can I wipe out my income? So let's say I have $10,000 a year that's hitting my tax return at my highest bracket. That flows into my regular tax return, and it's at my highest level. So let's say I'm a good pilot. I make a lot of money. Maybe you're married, and between the two of you, your spouse and you, you're making $500,000-$600,000 a year. You're at 37% plus your state tax. You're like, man, this sucks. Just having that extra depreciation might take that $10,000 off, and maybe it saves you $3,700.
Right.
What if it creates a loss? Now, this is where it gets interesting. I could have a loss, but if it's passive, I can't use it against any other type of income. I can't use it against my W-2. I can't use it against portfolio income, so I can't use it against interest or dividend.
I just want to clarify that, because you were saying that if, you know, you have that rental property and it creates a $10,000 gain, wouldn't that be classified? That would be classified as passive, but it flows onto your ordinary, and so you're getting taxed on it as ordinary. But if you get if you generate a loss, you can't use that against your W-2. So it's sort of a double-edged sword.
Right. So the rules are that there's three types of income.
Right.
There's active income, stuff you sweaty your brow, you're trading your service for money. You're materially participating in the activity. So you're going to pay ordinary income tax, plus you're going to pay Social Security, which is old age, disability, and survivors, and Medicare.
Right.
So you're getting hit with two different types of taxes when you earn money. And then there's everything else. So we have portfolio income, which is, think of it as investments. It's royalties, it's interest, it's dividends, it's capital gains. Those are taxed differently. They're not subject to to Social Security taxes. Notice I did not say rent in that, because rent is not portfolio income. Portfolio income are these other categories. And depending on your capital gains, for example, could be short-term taxed at ordinary rates, or long-term, which is 0, 15, or 20%, depending on how much money you make. None of those are subject to self-employment tax. Then you get to passive income. And by the way, capital gains, you could offset with capital losses. Capital losses can only be used against capital gains, except you can write off $3,000 a year if you have capital losses against your other income. So so there's restrictions depending on the type of income. The biggest is passive. When you have passive losses, like you could get from real estate, you can only use passive losses against passive income. In passive income, there's only two types. It's rents, or it's businesses that you do not materially participate in. So if I have, let's say I'm doing a syndication with Spartan, and Spartan's smart. They have good accountants, and they say, I'm going to cost seg and I'm going to create a loss. And you get this big fat loss. You did a $100,000 investment. You got a $75,000 paper loss that comes out to you, whatever it is, because they levered up and they cost segged. And I mean, storage, you can get some pretty like land improvements you write off right away. So it kicks you down this $75,000 loss. I didn't lose $75,000. But I'm sitting and looking at it. I can't use that against my W-2, right? But I can use it against other passive income. So if I have other rents, if I'm exiting a position and I have passive capital gains from leaving another syndication, I can use it against that. If I am investing in my brother Ned's pizza shop and he buys a big pizza oven and kicks down some loss, I'm just kidding. But let's just say that I had a passive business that I was investing in, and it was giving me money. Hey, here's your taxes. You made $25,000 on this thing. Your passive loss would offset it. And so when you see rich people and you start seeing them picking and choosing their investments, and they're talking to their accountant and they say, hey, I don't want to participate, but I'll be an equity owner, but I want to be a silent partner. What they're saying is, I need passive income. So I know it's not that I don't want to work with you and your business, but I can't materially participate because I need to keep it passive because I have all these syndication losses and I want to use them against that income. So I want to make a little bit of money, but I don't want to have to pay tax on it. then it starts to make sense. It all starts to be like, oh, now I see.
Yep.
How is income from a debt fund or being a private lender taxed, or how can that be offset, if it can at all?
Yeah. So interest income is considered portfolio income. So it's taxed as ordinary. It can only be offset with non-passive losses. So it has to be ordinary losses. Although there is one thing, like if you have investment expenses, so like if you borrowed money to invest in something, then you could actually write off the interest that you've had to pay against the income. So it's not like
an example of that.
Well, let's say that you borrowed money from
a HELOC.
HELOC would be great. I borrowed money and I have to pay 5% on it, and I put it in a fund and it made 8%. I could write, you know, what I'm going to pay tax on is the net, but I can't write off other expenses. I can't write off my cell phone against it, right? It's a different type of income, unless I am a bank or unless I rise to the level of a trader business. Now, what I do, I'll just give you guys what I would do if I was in that situation. I actually just talked to a bunch of note buyers, so this is timely, is I would say, you know what? I need to get income into an area that can actually write it off. Me personally, I can't write it off. But if I set up a partnership that holds an interest that's making money, and that partnership is me and a corporation. Let's say I have 20% ownership by a corporation and it makes money, then it can write off expenses. It can operate itself. It doesn't matter wherever it makes its money, it makes its money. It's corporate income. Who cares? Me, it's portfolio income, and it's flowing down to me as portfolio income. The 80%, I couldn't write off anything against unless I had some debt, you know, and I could write off the interest. So it's kind of like when you have money that you're making as an investment expense, there's certain types of, it's very limited on the type of expenses you can write off against it. If you have margin interest, for example, on a stock account, you might be able to write that off, but you can't write off computers or cell phones or things like that when you're trading, unless you qualify as a trader, which is a stupid thing I don't even want to get into. It's like people that do that just audit themselves. Like you may as well just put a target on your back, or you do the LLC tax as a corporate or as a partnership with a corporate with a corporation as one of the partners and usually the manager.
What's the most common offset you see someone who is a private lender to save on the taxes they would otherwise pay on that interest?
Yeah, it's really difficult. It's interest. So if they're borrowing money to make money, if they're borrowing money to loan money to make money, then they get the net. Otherwise, there's nothing, right? So it really comes down to most of those people, what I would tell them is, you know, if I'm going to do that, I'm probably going to do that in an IRA or a 401k or a Roth IRA. I'm going to try to make sure that it's exempt. And because it's ordinary income, if it hits me, it's in my highest tax bracket. Or you better make sure that you, in for somebody who has another business, they may not care because they're writing off all their expenses anyway. And they're like, all right, so it's a more ordinary income. I don't really care. You know, it's going to be at my ordinary rate, but it's not subject to self-employment tax. So I don't really care, you know, and it's better than nothing. It really comes down to that. So I know that there's folks that love doing debt, love buying notes or love doing debt funds. And it's, you're not getting punished. It's not like you're getting punished like you do when you make money. When I make money as a job, I get hit with two levels of tax. This is only one.
So to unpack this for anybody that, if this sounds foreign to you, a very simple way that you could look at this is if you were lending money to house flippers, right, at 9%, so that's kind of a common thing that I hear once in a while I've been lending money to this guy. He flips houses. He gives me my money back. Great interest rate. That'd be kind of a simplistic version of what we're talking about here.
Now, if you want to write off expenses or losses against any type of income, it just has to be ordinary loss. And the way you get ordinary loss is you materially participate in something. So here's one that throws people off a lot. Airbnb, when you are 7 days or less average stay. So you pick all the days that a property was rented during the year, divide it by the number of unique leases in essence, or, you know, unique visitors. you divide that up. And if it's like Airbnb is the average is 3 days, that's not a rental activity. That's actually an ordinary business. That's a trader business. So if you're materially participating, it's a non-passive loss. That would wipe out any type of income you have, even W-2 income.
Right. And I want to dig into this because I was just talking to someone yesterday about this specific thing. So if you own, say, 5 houses and 4 of them were long-term leases and 1 was an Airbnb, you'd mm-hmm. probably want to conduct the cost segregation study on the Airbnb house first, right? Because if you're a high income earner, you'd be able to use the depreciation from that asset against your W-2. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. Yes. But I'm going to give you like the big but.
Yeah.
It depends on if you could qualify as a real estate professional. Mm-hmm. So if I am qualifying for
right. real estate and this would be, I want to set the table for the real estate professional because this is so important. So if you were like, hey, I can't qualify as the real estate professional. I don't have 750 hours a year to dedicate to this. My spouse mm-hmm. doesn't either. We're completely, it's out the window. I can't qualify as a real estate professional. Then mm-hmm. You're going to be looking for opportunities to buy short-term rentals, right? Because then you can use the depreciation.
Hey, Tate, I'll make it messed up.
Yes.
You only have to do it for 1 year. Like I could have a short-term rental this year and then make it into a long-term. So all the time, I get this. Somebody was going to buy a property and say they're going to buy it in October. And I'm like, whatever you do, do not let somebody else manage it. You manage it and make it into an Airbnb and you do everything. Well, I don't want to do everything. I'm like, let's just run the numbers. Would you do it for $100,000? Yeah, I'd do it for $100,000. All right. Here's the value. You just bought a house. It's $500,000. $100,000 of land, $400,000 of improvement. Let's do a cost seg on it. It's going to be about 30% of that improvement value, $120,000 loss that you can use to offset your other income. So, you know, you're going
to get in. And if it was long-term in the first year, you'd only be able to apply that loss to other passive income. But if it's at Airbnb that first year, you get to offset your W-2.
Yeah. So you look at it and say, how much are you paying on your W-2? Oh, I'm making $500,000 a year. Okay. It doesn't even have to be you. It could be you or a spouse. Right. You guys add your time together when you're doing material participation. So all you have to do is meet material participation test, which is you're doing substantially all the, you know, you're managing the Airbnb, right? So you still put this in an LLC. You're just letting it flow down to you and maybe make it a disregarded LLC so you don't have to file a tax return for it. But this money's going to go onto your tax return. And the only question really comes down to, did you materially participate? So you have $120,000 loss, plus you still get to grab your regular depreciation. You do have to recognize the income that you made from the Airbnb, but you've only had it for a couple months. So you only had it for a little while. It's okay, great. Let's write that puppy off. And then the next year, bring somebody in to manage it or make it into a long-term rental. But I just took a huge chunk of that deduction and I took it this year.
That's genius because I always thought you had to leave it as an Airbnb. So I didn't think of the fact that you only needed it that first year when you're doing the cost segregation study.
No, the test for whether it's a rental or not is an annual test. The test for whether you're a real estate professional or not is an annual test. So the reason I hesitated first when you had 5 properties is I might need that 5th property if I'm a real estate professional, right? Maybe I'm trying to qualify, which is 750 hours, 1 spouse in a real estate trader business. Doesn't even have to be mine. So I could be a real estate agent, for example, or I could be construction, or I could be a developer, or I could be a property manager. And I materially participate on my rental properties. And it's each property individually, unless I aggregate my rental properties. Right. So there's actually court cases on this, tax court cases, where somebody would have qualified had they not had a dang Airbnb or two, right? And the way we make those into long-term rentals, if we need them, is you put the Airbnb in an LLC and you rent it to a corporation that then acts as the host. And voila, now I have, now if I need it to qualify as the real estate professional because I need those hours that I spent on that property to qualify for material participation, then now I can actually use it.
Ryan, I know you're trying to jump in here.
Yeah, thanks, Tate. I want to talk about the downside to depreciation, or maybe demyth this or debunk the theory. What happens when we sell, right? We get all these great write-offs. We get all this great offsets, but then we go to sell the property. What about recapture, or what happens then?
Yeah. So when you depreciate 1250 property, which is the structure, when you sell it, if you've depreciated anything, you recapture that depreciation. So I wrote it off and now I have to recapture it. But when you recapture it, it's at your ordinary rate, maxed out at 25%. So most people just say it's 25%. So I have to recapture it. When I recapture 1245 property, which is personal property, like the carpet, the improvements, the fence, the driveway, the appliances, I recapture those based off the useful life of the property. And I recapture that at my ordinary rate, which is 0 to 37%. But here's the thing. If its useful life is done, so I hold a property for 5 years, I pay no recapture on the 5-year property. If I sell it after 5 years and I have 7-year property, I might have a small amount of recapture. If it's 15-year property, it's going to be some recapture, but it's not what you guys think. When we do these analysis, generally speaking, if you've held it for at least a few years, 4 or 5 years, the recapture is almost always better when you've actually done the cost seg, because most of those assets, a big chunk of it's going to be that 5-year property. And we don't like it. It's not earth shattering, the difference, but you know, we've actually done cost segs. Get this. There was one property I could think of off the top of my head. It was purchased in, I think it was a 5-year hold, and it was purchased for 2.8 and it was sold for 3.3. That was the expected basis amount. So the land, let's exclude the land. So there was a good chunk of gain, 2.5 to 3.3 is what, but I believe it was about 800,000. So the tax, when it was all said and done between the recapture and the capital gain, was 280,000 ish. It was right around, I think it was 278. When we did the cost seg, it lowered that to 212. And so there was a substantial difference, right? There was a big difference. It was, you know, 60 some thousand bucks, I think is what it was, 60 or 70. It was right around there. It was a large amount. And if people are thinking, like, I can't do that. I already sold it. I sold it last year. Actually, as long as you can get access to the property, you can actually do the cost seg, even for last year. Yeah, so they were able to do it. Cost segs aren't free, obviously, but you're looking at, and I always say, if I can get 7 times a return on it, so I say, is the juice worth the squeeze? If I'm going to look at doing something, I'm going to spend $1, I want to get $7 back at least.
One of the main reasons why we structure our syndications at Spartan to be 5-year holds, mm-hmm, is for this tax purpose, which we want to be tax efficient. So usually we provide the investor with enough depreciation in year one to offset any passive activity that they would get from distributions. And then, mm-hmm, by the time we sell in year five, the depreciation on the 5-year life has been exhausted. So that's not the only reason why we do 5-year holds, but it's more of a tax efficient strategy.
Well, interesting.
And here's the thing, like, let's say I'm going to have income coming in off a property. Even if I do a cost seg and I end up with passive loss, you don't lose them. You carry them forward.
And Toby, can I just before we move on, I just want to stop for a second and just jump into cost segregation studies as a subject, because I think a lot of people that are newer to real estate investing, or they own a couple of properties, a lot of people haven't heard of these. So could you just explain very briefly, you know, what they are? You know, it's a joint project between an accountant and an engineer, what they cost and how to find somebody to go and do something like this to your property, whether you have a, you know, just a house or a little apartment complex.
Yeah. So, absolutely. What a cost seg study is breaking a property, instead of just using the default of 27 and a half years or 39 years, breaking its components down into the 5, 7, or 15 year components. It requires an engineer, somebody who's a professional, to actually do the study.
I was going to say, because pilots are really good at doing everything. So, I mean, they could do this on an Excel spreadsheet, right?
Yeah, no, but they could. It's just that it just wouldn't pass muster with the IRS, is all.
Exactly.
So, yeah. You know, so on it, upon examination, they would be in for a sad surprise. But
by the way, I'm happy to share one in the show notes.
Great.
I'll put a copy of a real one we did for a self-storage facility, and we'll just link it in the show notes.
How much did that one cost you, Ryan? And how big was the property?
The property actually is Tate, the one that you invested in. It was about 950 units. And at the time, it was 735 units, self-storage facility in Corsicana, Texas.
Yep.
And I believe we paid about $5,000 for the study.
Not bad.
And we've got about the purchase of the facility was about $6 million, and we had about a $2.2 million write-off in the first year with that cost seg study, or thereabouts. I can't remember the exact number, but there were some adjustments the accountant made. And to your point, Toby, or Tate, I think you said, you know, the cost seg study is produced by the engineer, and then you hand it off to your CPA, and the CPA may make some adjustments, and that's what ours did to get the depreciation actually a little bit higher. So
what you're really doing is you're writing things off as they should be. And I think I said it earlier, it's the 3115 when you're making a change of accounting methodology. And it says you're going from an impermissible method to a permissible method by breaking these things down. You're actually supposed to be doing the cost seg study. It's in your benefit. The IRS says you don't have to because it's in your detriment. Now, let's say that in your case, Ryan, it kicked down this $2 million worth of passive loss and they couldn't use it. They would just carry it forward and continue to offset their passive income. The other thing they might do is use it against passive capital gains from exiting another syndication. And it's kind of this weird subject area where people think capital gains are capital gains, but they're not. When you've been involved in a passive activity and you cash out, the capital gains will be considered passive capital gains. So passive income will offset it. Passive losses will offset it. So remember, passive losses only offset passive income. So now I have passive income. It's capital gains, but it's passive. And if I have losses from another syndication I just joined, I won't pay any tax on that.
Toby, this is what I talked with you about before the show, which is this lazy man's 1031, right? We get questions all the time in terms of, hey, if I invest in the syndication deal or in this deal with Spartan or in this deal with Turbine, what happens when we sell? Am I going to owe all this capital gain? And well, if you just go and reinvest it again, you're going to have more losses that are generated that you can offset that. So
anyway, yeah, when you have capital gains, you have three choices, really. I guess is the easiest way to look at it. You can do a qualified opportunity zone and dump it into something and defer it for a couple of years. You could use capital losses that you have because you invested in the stock market when it was raging hot and then it took a complete dump.
Right.
Or you use your passive losses from another syndication. All of those will work, right? But, you know, you kind of have to push your accountant into these things. Quite often they just want to compartmentalize it. Oh, that's capital gain. Now, here's the other thing. When you leave a syndication, if you have a passive loss carry forward, it gets released. So same thing. Let's say I invested in Ryan's deal and it was $6 million and you got a $2 million deduction. And I was a portion of that. And I had, you know, $100,000 of loss I didn't get to use. And they exit, the $100,000 gets released. And it's going to get used against, generally, it's going to get used against the gain. You're like, oh, okay, it's just going to wipe out the gain first off. And then any of that other capital gain, I'm going to go find more passive losses to offset it. Or it could just be, it's just ordinary loss. Use it against even your W-2 income if you end up with a loss in that situation.
And you highlighted this in the first time, the last show. And I really wanted to dig into this, because you were saying that, you know, most accountants will just use that against other losses. Is it required to be used against other losses before it can go to your W-2?
No, you actually get to choose as long as you have a loss. I think that the property itself, and I'm not looking at the provision, but I think the general rule is that most people would use it against the property itself and it's going to create a net loss or gain. If it's a net loss, you can pick against it, whatever type of income you want. It's your choice. You don't have to use it against capital gain. You could use it against your ordinary income if the tax bracket's higher. It's your pick. So if you have W-2 income, then yeah, you could absolutely use it to offset your W-2 income. And just because I like being, just button this thing up, just because you have passive loss doesn't mean it's just that's the end all be all. There's two other ways to use the passive losses and make them into ordinary. The first one is it's probably not going to be applicable to you guys because you have to be making less than $150,000 a year. And that's if you're an active participant in real estate. You pick the manager, whatever. The other one is the real estate professional. And what real estate professional status does is it makes your passive losses ordinary or non-passive. So now all of a sudden, any year that you qualify, 750 hours, more than 50% of your time in a real estate trader business, boom, I qualify. I materially participate on my activities. Yay, I qualify. Voila, I just released all my passive loss and made them ordinary. Even the syndications, which is why you look at it and go, wait a second, I didn't do anything on that syndication. That's why we aggregate all your rental activities together. You never do this just on your own. Make sure you're talking to your accountant because you want to make sure that you're not hanging out some passive loss that all of a sudden is part of the group, because now getting rid of one property may not release passive loss. Obviously, it wouldn't, because we're making it into ordinary loss. But if you have some passive losses you haven't used, you'd have to get rid of all of your rental activities to release that. But if you don't have a bunch of passive loss carry forwards, you might be jumping all over this because you say, like, wait a second. I mean, like, my spouse could qualify for real estate professional. And now every time I go do a Ryan and Tate deal, I get this big loss. It's not passive and it's going to wipe out my W-2 income. And you're like, yes, absolutely.
So Ryan and I have both been claiming real estate professional status for ages. And it's incredible.
Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb and ask a really crazy question. I don't know what my CPA did at the time, but I was an airline pilot and that was my active income. That's what showed up in my tax return. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, I had so much depreciation on my tax return that they were able to look back 5 years and wipe out taxes in the past because I transitioned to a full-time real estate professional. And I got this like massive check in the mail and it was really cool. I was very, 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 very happy. It was like a lot of money. So what was that all about? What happened there?
Well, you did the exact same thing that our past president Trump did.
Oh,
cool. So everybody acts like bonus depreciation is new and carrybacks are new. And the Great Recession, the Obama administration did the exact same thing. And they said, we need to spur economic activity. How are we going to do that? We need people to invest in real estate. And at that time, everybody was running away from real estate like it was on fire because they had just gotten the bejesus beaten out of them, right? They were like, forget this real estate crap. So our past President Trump, we just call him President Trump, bought a building in New York and he cost-segged it. And at the time, I forget the name of the act, but they allowed the They said, hey, if you get this loss, you can carry it back. So you can carry back ordinary losses 5 years. And you take it 5 years, use it up, keep moving it ahead. They did the same thing under the CARES Act when COVID hit. And they said, we already had bonus depreciation, but they said, you can carry it back. So if you did that, I think it was 2020.
Yep.
You could carry it back to 2015. And you keep using it until it's gone. So what that did in 2020 is it made everybody go, I need some more real estate. Anybody who's a real estate professional is literally going bonkers looking for real estate. Like, where can you sell me some real estate? They're going to the guy in the corner going, psst.
Well, I was just dumb luck because I was buying real estate anyway. And then my accountant showed up and he said, hey, you're going to get a big check in the mail because we're going to wipe out all your taxes for the past 5 years.
Carry back 5 years. How long is that going to last? How many years is that going to go forward?
It's gone.
Gotcha.
Seen that one on South Park where what's the angry
and
little
and it's gone.
And I'm gonna put my $100 in invested in a few things.
I wanna ask, there's probably some house flippers out there that are thinking they can depreciate their house flips. Can you talk about that? About what you can't depreciate, or what kind of makes the threshold?
Yeah, you depreciate 1250 and 1245 property, which has useful lives. Inventory I cannot depreciate. So when you're a house flipper, they don't consider that you're buying a capital asset for a long-term investment. They think you're buying inventory, no different than if you were a car lot. In other words, the car guy that, you know, your Ford dealership down the street doesn't write off all the cars. They only write it off as cost of goods sold when they sell one. So when you're flipping property, you're considered a dealer, and you lose the ability to do things like installment sales. Like, it's ugly. Do not do installment sales on flips, please, because I'll need extra Kleenex, you know, because you'll be crying so hard. I mean, I've had people just annihilate themselves on this stuff because they'll.
Yeah. So if you're out there flipping houses and you're selling them right away, you're building inventory per the IRS, which means you're going to be paying ordinary rates on those flips. One strategy that I've seen real estate investors do is, instead of selling the asset right when they build it or flip it, they'll rent it out for like a year or two, and then get the better tax rate. How long do they have to hold it though? What's the length of time, or what do they have to do, or what intention do they have to have? I think there's some.
So there's a case. I think it's Alvin v. Commissioner. Yeah, it's Alvin v. Commissioner. I think it's what it was. They bought a property and they intended, hey, we're going to sell it, and the market turned south. So they held it and rented it for 10 years. And then they sold it, and they were a dealer, which was brutal. So how long do you have to hold it? Doesn't matter. When you bought it, what matters is what was your intent. If you bought it for long-term appreciation and cash flow, then you could sell it right away. If you bought it to flip, it doesn't matter. If the IRS comes through and says, you know, we think you bought it, like, usually they're looking at facts and circumstances. So if you're buying properties and selling them, and then you buy one and hold it, wait 2 years and then sell it, they're going to say, aha, I've got you. So what we do is we advise people, if you're going to be a flipper, flip through an S corp or a C corp. And if you're going to keep it long, then sell it at its fair market value once you realize you're going to keep it long. So if I'm flipping a property, and I'm like, oh, you know what? I really want to keep this one. Sell it to a different entity, and you're going to recognize the gain on that. It's going to be ordinary income. It's going to be subject to self-employment tax and all that good stuff, which is why you use a S corp so you can minimize that.
What if my intention is to buy, you know, buy this house, fix it up, enter it into service for a year, and then sell it? Is that good intention?
No, Ryan, what was your intention when you bought it? To hold it long-term or to sell it?
Well, what's long-term?
A long time, like a long, long period of time. You know, were you even thinking about selling it, right? It's this weird thing, right? Yeah. They look at it and say, what was your intent? Was your intent for the long-term appreciation and cash flow, or was your intent to hold it and sell it? It's what they could prove. Right. So off the facts you just said, right? Hey, I bought it and I was going to hold it for a year, then sell it. Your intent was to sell it in the IRS. So, I don't care how long you held it.
Yeah. So asking for a friend who developed real estate.
Yeah.
And likes to maintain optionality.
Yeah.
Buy an entitled land and flip it, get a property to a certificate of occupancy and sell it, or enter it into service long term. What happens when you have optionality as a stated business plan? Asking for a friend.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is that's why you make sure that when you buy and if the inkling is that you're going to sell for some reason, and then you decide to keep it long, there a bunch of tax journals have hit this and there's cases on it. You sell it to the long-term entity.
Okay.
So, hey, you know what? I was just going to flip it through the business. And then you say, you know what? I really want to just keep it long-term. I would say sell it to a different business, recognize your gain on that portion. My sale is now over. I'm going to keep that long-term and throw it over into another entity, because that way the IRS can see it. Otherwise, they don't know what you are, and they're going to say facts and circumstances. So they're going to look at you and your friend, and they're going to say, what does this friend do? Oh, he buys properties. gets their land use, does some development, and developers are flippers too, does some development and then sells it. And hey, look, he's done that 10 times. It doesn't matter what you did on the 11th property. They already know what you are. And you say, but this one's different. And they're going to be like, it's like a car dealer. I've got that.
Well, it's
one.
A good thing we don't ever really sell anything. So,
yeah. Well, a good strategy for anybody who is going to fix something up, buy it, fix it up, and their intention is to hold it long term. Look at the refinance, right? There's Brandon Turner wrote a book, The Burr Method or whatever, buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. So it's a good way of boosting value, refinancing it, taking a bunch of your cash back out through the refinance, which is tax free, by the way, because it's a loan, not a sale. And yep. Kind of juicy.
No, that's right. But your intent is to hold it long term on the appreciation, exactly. And then to wait until you die, and then it steps up in basis. Yeah, Brendan's great, and great methodology. Buy an asset, put a bunch of value into it. I might change that a little bit because I'm a tax guy, so I might say buy rent,
right. Rehab.
Right. Rent again, refinance.
Put it into service and then rehab.
Put it into service right away. I want that depreciation. Yes. I don't want to wait until it's actually in service. So.
I've got an investment. So we did a syndication. We bought a self-storage facility in Tyler, Texas. And what's really cool is the investors on it get the benefit of a refinance. And we're going to pull out, I think, $1.2 million next month. And they get that money back. It's from a refinance.
So here's the rub on that. When you give people back their money up until their capital is made whole. So like if I put in $100,000 and you give me $100,000 back, I don't have to pay tax on it. But if I refi and I'm not at risk, so I'm just a passive investor, then when you give me additional money, so let's say you give me $120,000 back and I only gave you $100,000, I have to pay long-term capital gains on the $20,000.
Got it. So in this case, a $50,000 investor is getting about $12,000 back.
Oh, they're fine. Fine as wine.
So they don't have to pay tax. Okay. That's good to know.
Yep. It always comes down to, are you at risk when it comes to debt? And how much money you're getting back out. So like usually when it's just Joe and Jill, married couple, whatever, and they refi a property, they're on the hook for it. So it doesn't matter. They can take way more than they put in. Hey, I bought a property for $100,000. I fixed it up. I put $200,000 into it. I have $300,000 of basis, but the property's worth $1 million and I just borrowed $500,000, not a taxable event.
So we've had some pilots reach out to us and say, hey, I reached out to Anderson Advisors, and they felt like the service was overpowering for what they needed just as airline pilots. Mm-hmm. I love the service Anderson provides. Can you kind of provide a little bit of detail into what type of profile of a person or a business owner would really benefit from calling Anderson? Because I do want to kind of plug Anderson a little bit on the podcast. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. So Anderson's looking at four things, right? It's, hey, are you exposed? Do we have exposure? Is there a way to minimize that exposure? So if you're renting or you're buying rental properties, for example, we look at it both, hey, the property could burn down and harm somebody. Are they going to garnish you for the rest of your life? Right. If you're an airline pilot, there's a good chance, like even if you tried to BK it, you know, they're going to continue to hit you. I've actually done that. I've gone after people. This is a gal that was with Boeing. I garnished her for over 11 years. So yeah, it's like just because you think you can get out of something doesn't mean you can actually get out of it. So you look at the asset protection, then you also look at it and say, what other activities are you doing? Like, is there any liability that you're creating as an individual? We all do when we drive around and we talk and we communicate, and we can hit, you know, we drive into a busload of nuns and they sue the heck out of us and they try to take what we have. So you look at lawsuit, you look at tax. Hey, is there a way that we can minimize our tax burden? Are there things that we could do? And you look at your business planning. Hey, am I making myself unlendable? Like if I'm Ryan Gibson and I carry back all these losses for 5 years and I go to get a loan.
You've made no money for the last 5 years.
Yeah, you haven't made a dollar. Like, what are you doing? Living underneath a bridge? You know, so, you know, most good lenders know depreciation. They'll add it back in. But there is that, hey, do I have enough income? And then you have estate planning. Do I have a legacy plan? Is it going to be given? So when somebody walks in and they think, you know what, I'm just W-2. and all I have is a syndication. We're still looking at all four. And we're saying, hey, in a syndication, you're isolated from the liability of the syndication. Do you have any other exposure? Should we hold that syndication in a virtual safe, like a Wyoming LLC where they can't take it and they can't see it? So, you know, so there's that. You know what? Honestly, probably not, right? If that's all you're doing as an airline pilot, probably not. Tax, oh, there's not much we can do there. Do you have any other tax, you know, are there any businesses you have? Would there be a reason to structure it? And let's just say you say, no, we have no other side gigs, no other activities. All right, so probably nothing there. You go to the business planning. Hey, you know, this syndication is going to go on page two of your schedule. It's really not, there's not much there from a business planning standpoint. You're not on the hook for the loans. And then we go to the estate planning and say, everybody needs a living trust. So with somebody who, because you don't want to go into probate and you want to make sure that you have advocates for your medical, power of attorney, your financial, all that stuff. It's like, do not go through life without having somebody listed on a piece of paper who gets access to your medical, who can actually make decisions on your behalf if you're incapacitated, and then avoid probate like the plague. AARP did a study a long time ago, and they found that the average basic probate is about 20% of the estate. So you look at this stuff and you're like, okay, what would somebody who came in that's just a W-2 earner that's a pilot, what would they really need? Probably a living trust. That's probably going to be good enough if all they're doing is a syndication. They're doing more, it might be more. But they're probably looking at it going, why am I going through this whole process? And why is somebody drafting up this plan and looking at my entire scenario? And it's because we're trying to address all four things and making sure that you actually have a plan going forward. It might seem overwhelming when you first look at it, but then you have to step back and say, but where am I right now today? And it might be that it's as simple as an estate plan.
An estate plan is for everybody. I'd probably say, you know, liability protection and everything else. I mean, that might be overkill if you're just an airline pilot and you're not doing a ton of activity, like you were saying, to get liability protection. But once you start adding in the rental portfolio and some other things, really good time to give you guys a call. So,
yeah, well, the syndication is an LLC, right? So why do I need to put another LLC around the LLC? The only reason I would do that is if I had a bunch of liabilities, like if I had exposure, maybe I had another business, or maybe there was something else that I was engaged in as an individual, like a doctor or somebody where you had professional exposure that could exceed insurance. And you're like, gosh, you know what? I just don't want them to take my syndication interest. Then you might put it in there. Otherwise, there's already an LLC protecting you, right?
If somebody, would you say a living trust is probably the best way to title your holdings in a syndication?
Yes. Either you're holding your syndication separate from the other investments because there's exposure. So you have other rental properties, and I'd isolate this syndication. But in a basic world, W-2, I have a job. Make sure that it's not in your name. Just make sure a living trust. And that is just because we don't know what's going to happen to us, and we don't want to get it tied up in a probate process. Even though it seems really simple, it's like, hey, you know what? It's a pain. Don't go through probate.
I mean, we used to buy rental property in our early days of Spartan from people who didn't set up living trusts, and things went to probate and it got messy. And that's where we not took advantage of the people, but sort of that's where the value was, because everybody was fighting over who owned the property, and then it was just a mess.
Usually,
so please, you know, go put all your stuff in a trust. It really is beneficial. Maybe we'll have you, Toby, back or Clint to talk about trusts, or whoever the best person is at Anderson.
Yeah, I think we were planning on having an episode with Clint about asset protection and trusts and LLCs and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I think that's got a whole episode written all over it.
Clint's going to scare the pants off you just because we get to see all these messed up scenarios where you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I'll give you one. Rocket scientist, literally a rocket scientist, right? They come and, oh, you know, I just had my house and I bought another property. It was my dream property. It's where we're going to move in when we retire. We didn't really need anything. And they're talking to me and I'm like, well, actually there's exposure. What did you do with that property? Well, we just did a complete rehab on it. And we rented it to this nice family. We were like, but we're going to move there in a couple of years. We're almost retired. You already know the end of the story, right?
Yep.
That family flooded the hell out of it. They like quite literally turned on whatever, somebody clogged the drain downstairs with a paper towel or not with a washcloth or something, one of the kids, and flooded the downstairs. And of course, this wonderful family immediately called the landlord and said, I am so sorry. can, you know, I will fix it. I'll dry it out. I'll bring in a remediation company. No, that's not what they did. They let it fester. It became moldy. Then they tore out the carpet. They brought in a guy from the University of Denver and sued the hell out of the client. And the lawyer kept saying, because these folks were from California, you're obviously wealthy. You live in X, you know, in the area where they lived. I won't say because I don't want to give them away. They got to deal with that. They ended up winning the lawsuit, $250,000 out of pocket. Oh, but the insurance is going to cover. No, it doesn't. Not on mold claims. Not most of the time they don't. And here's this person got to deal with this joyous occasion. And I always hear that. I'm like, I always hear people like, oh, it's not a big deal. Oh, I just have a second house. Oh, I have this. Oh, I have that. Until you've been sued, you don't get it. It's $20,000, $30,000 a month out of your pocket and a constant aggravation and showing up at depositions. And at 3 a.m., you're staring at the ceiling and you're thinking of all the Matlock thing you're going to do to the other person. And then you start thinking of illegal things you're going to do to the other person. And you just get angry. That's what, like, there's not justice in a courthouse. Like, avoid it like the plague. And just to reiterate, that's why you don't go to probate. It's your worst behavior on your worst day. That's what you're inflicting on somebody else. And it's usually a loved one. And rarely does it end up being a good thing. And a probate lawyer, oh, it's not a big deal. To you, it might not be a big deal because you're doing it all day long. It's traumatic for everybody else. Stay out of court.
Well, on that note, Toby, how do people get in touch with you and engage with Anderson?
Toby Mathis, just Google it, YouTube. I have a pretty good size.
Yeah, I gotta plug the, yeah, definitely in the show notes. Toby has what, almost 2 million views on his most viewed YouTube video. Incredible resource. So go check that out. I wanted to get more into the real estate professional status, but I think we touched on it sufficiently. And we need to kind of bring this thing home anyway. I want to be respectful of your time, but, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I'm sorry. And Ryan,
real quick. So, this is, airing. This is Tuesday when this episode is out. Yep. Toby, how do people join Tax Tuesday today? Like, if they wanted to join Tax Tuesday, where would they go?
They can go to my YouTube channel and we stream it live. And you can
YouTube.
Yeah. Perfect. So Tax Tuesday, it's every other Tuesday.
Yeah.
So I don't know which Tuesday this is going to go out on, but
this is going to go out on Tuesday,
This is May 2nd.
May 2nd.
Yeah, it's probably not today. It's going to be the next Tuesday, but you just go in there and you can see it. You can register for it on our website too, but ask any tax question you want. We'll just answer them. Last time we had 20 flipping staff. You know, there's about 500 of us here at Anderson. And I always say to the accountants and the attorneys, anybody want to come in and answer questions? Because we get several hundred questions. Yeah, it was pretty darn hilarious. I think we had 700 people asking questions. And we had 20 staff just knocking them out. But we go over questions that people submit and go over those live and then answer your questions that you ask. It's private, so you don't have to worry about your question flashing up there. But yeah, it's one of those reaping and sowing things. I'm a big believer in it. And so we just try to answer your questions so you don't have to waste your time and money trying to get an answer.
Excellent.
I love it.
Love it. Well, check out Toby on YouTube. Check out Anderson Advisors. Thanks again for coming on, mate.
It was fun.
Take care.
Thanks, Toby.